everyone. This podcast is a tribute to mark the 150th birth anniversary of the father of our Indian nation. It is certainly an opportune time to revisit, rejudge, and replicate Mahatma Gandhi's credo and vision, especially on conflict resolution in contemporary times. These times when conflicts have become like an epidemic. Conflicts, be it at the interpersonal, interstate, intrastate, national, or even at the national level, have continued to remain an intrinsic part of humankind. Conflicts are not bad or negative per se. They reflect the diversity of opinions and interests, as well as beliefs, and should be seen as a catalyst for change. But yes, when these conflicts become aggressive, assertive, and violent, causing harm to others and even to one's own self, then indeed it is a cause of worry and certainly needs to be addressed. Many writers have pointed out that it is neither necessary nor desirable to encompass various types of conflicts or even the conflicts within one's own self under one general theory. So different conflicts have different perspective and different solution. This podcast is an attempt to understand and analyze Gandhi's thoughts and beliefs on conflict resolution by understanding his unique characteristics and methodology and how these can be gainfully employed in the present context of the changing geopolitical world order. वैष्णव जन तो तेरे कृष्ण जे The genesis of Gandhi's conflict resolution is related to no one particular event of his times, but rather a confluence of innumerable ideas, influences, incidents, religious beliefs, and values of the rich cultural heritage of the Indian civilization. His first school, his family, helped him imbibe the moral values of honesty, integrity, and helped him in building a strong character, which left an indomitable impression on his personality. His moral values of honesty, integrity from his father Karamchand Gandhi, religious piety and devotion from his mother Putli Bai, and of course, the external influences of Ruskin, Tolstoy and Thoreau left a long-lasting impression on his ideas. From Ruskin, he learned trust and nobleness in human nature, of course, supremacy of the spirit. From Tolstoy's writing, he understood the idea of love and non-violence. From Thoreau's practice of refusing to pay taxes to the government exposed him to the idea of civil disobedience, which he later used for the larger problems of social and political life. From his wife, Kasturba Gandhi, whom he believed was his tutor on practicing non-violence. He believed that all kinds of conflict resolution, or satyagraha as he says, begin with the peaceful solution of small interpersonal conflicts which are there in everyone's home. So non-violence like charity begins at home. Gandhi's example is instructive. He said, and I quote, "I learned the lesson of non-violence from my wife when I tried to bend her over my will. Her determined resistance to my will on the one hand and her quiet submission to the suffering on the other ultimately made me ashamed of myself and cured me of my stupidity. She became my teacher in non-violence." So Gandhi believed that the productive conflict resolution is likely to be achieved when it is based on the principles of non-violence and truth. So what is Satyagraha? I'm going to give you 5 points of analysis on Satyagraha. Gandhi evolved Satyagraha as the most pragmatic and potent technique of conflict resolution. For him, Satyagraha is a technique of action wherein the ideal of love reigns in the place of hatred and killing. It is based on truth and it works through non-violence and is achieved by converting or compelling the opponent through self-suffering. Hence, for him, Satyagraha is the best technique for conflict resolution. So what is Satyagraha? The etymology of the word Satyagraha comes from Gujarati word Satyagraha. From Sanskrit, satya, satya means truth, agraha, agraha means persistence. So satyagraha means what Gandhi calls truth force or soul force. Point number two, this satyagraha is applicable for all conflict situations, from interpersonal to group to national, international, micro level, and even at the micro level. But the point to be made here is that its fundamental unit remains the individual. Ultimately, all satyagraha is a personal matter. Even in mass movements or mass satyagraha, if a single satyagrahi holds out to the end, victory is certain, he believed. It is the law of love. It is not to destroy or harass the opponent, but to convert or win him by sympathy, patience, and self-suffering. Satyagrahi hates all evils and will never compromise with it. He approaches the evil doer through love and realization. This he evolved in his time spent in South Africa. Of course, later developed wisely in his views in India's freedom struggle. Point number three, a satyagrahi must have certain basic assumptions. What are those? Number one, certain beliefs have to be nurtured, like common interest between conflicting parties always exist. Second, address the psychological issues. For instance, never humiliate or embarrass the opponent. Number two, appeal never to your fear, but always to your heart. Number three, carry forward satyagraha to the final destination or the end. Four, clarity and transparency about the essential purpose and elements of conflict. 5. Resolving a conflict not based on injuring the opponent. Number 6. Basic and common interest of the opponent to be explored. Number 7. Dialogues encouraged always on probable doables. And number 7. Trust the opponent. Convert the opponent by reasoning, persuasion, and moral appeal through self-suffering, in lieu of violence or coercion. Point number three, truth and non-violence remains the core of satyagraha. Like I said, the final aim is not mere victory in narrow sense, but a relentless search for truth, which is certainly higher and certainly bigger aim. So satyagraha, variously described as non-violent resistance, non-violent direct action, militant non-violence, etc., is certainly distinguished from passive resistance or the weapon of the weak. So the means to achieve satyagraha is non-violence, and the end is to attain truth. Point number four, dialectical method of conflict resolution. Gandhiji believed that it is a morally correct way to conduct conflict because it is only through a dialectical process that truth can be arrived at, or at least approached. And such quest for truth, according to him, is the aim of life. He firmly believed that the greater the degree of non-violence exhibited by the satyagrahi, the greater the chances of success. Hence, he always believed that violence to persons and property has the effect of clouding the real issues involved in the original conflict, while non-coercive and non-violent action invites parties to a dialogue about the issues themselves. So hence, Gandhi's conflict resolution methodology was dialectical as well as moral in nature. And why dialectical? Because of these few reasons that he said, hate the sin, not the sinner. Second, the opponent to be seen as a valuable human being. Use of non-violent and non-coercive approaches are required, with the main objective was to create new possibilities, new opportunities for cooperation and coexistence. And hence, this all happens when change in the attitude and behavior of the opponent is required. Point number five in our analysis is the purest form of satyagraha. What is that? The purest form is when the opponent mutually agrees and believes in the shared goals of the conflicting parties. So it is not only a win-win situation for both the conflictual parties, but this also helps in transformation of the conflict by addressing the structural needs of the conflicting parties. So this is a long-term process, certainly, but once achieved, it brings long-lasting resolution and positive peace. So let's hear in Mahatma Gandhi in his own words.
There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I do not see it. It is this unseen power which makes itself felt and yet defies all proof, because it is so unlike all that I perceive through my senses. It transcends the senses. But it is possible to reason out the existence of God to a limited extent. Even in ordinary affairs, we know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules. In my tour last year in Mysore, I met many poor villagers, and I found upon inquiry that they did not know who ruled Mysore. They simply said, some god ruled it. If the knowledge of these poor people was so limited about their ruler, I, who am infinitely lesser in respect to God than they to their ruler, need not be surprised if I do not realize the presence of God, the King of Kings. Nevertheless, I do feel, as the poor villagers felt about Mysore, that there is orderliness in the universe. There is an unalterable law governing everything and every being that exists or lives. It is not a blind law, for no blind law can govern the conduct of living beings. And thanks to the marvelous researches of Sir J.C. Bose, it can now be proved that even matter is life. That law, then, which governs all life is God. Law and the lawgiver are one. I may not deny the law or the lawgiver because I know so little about it or him. Just as my denial or ignorance of the existence of an earthly power will avail me nothing, even so, my denial of God and His law will not liberate me from its operation, whereas humble and mute acceptance of divine authority makes life's journey easier, even as the acceptance of earthly rule makes life under it easier. I do dimly perceive that whilst everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is underlying all that change a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates. That informing power of spirit is God, and since nothing else that I see merely through the senses can or will persist, He alone is. And is this power benevolent or malevolent? I see it as purely benevolent, for I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good. But He is no God who merely satisfies the intellect, if He ever does. God, to be God, must rule the heart and transform it. he must express himself in every smallest act of his votary. This can only be done through a definite realization, more real than the five senses can ever produce. Sense perceptions can be and often are false and deceptive, however real they may appear to us. Where there is realization outside the senses, it is infallible. It is proved not by extraneous evidence, but in the transformed conduct and character of those who have felt the real presence of God within. Such testimony is to be found in the experiences of an unbroken line of prophets and sages in all countries and climes. To reject this evidence is to deny oneself. This realization is preceded by an immovable faith. He who would, in his own person, test the fact of God's presence can do so by a living faith. And since faith itself cannot be proved by extraneous evidence, the safest course is to believe in the moral government of the world, and therefore in the supremacy of the moral law, the law of truth and love. Exercise of faith will be the safest where there is a clear determination, summarily, to reject all that is contrary to truth and love. I confess that I have no argument to convince through reason. Faith transcends reason. All I can advise is not to attempt the impossible.
What is the relevance of Gandhian concept of conflict resolution? Well, let me put it this way. Gandhian conflict resolution methodology is more relevant than any other approach in the field of peace and conflict research. And why do I say that? I'm going to give you five analytical reasons for the same. Gandhian approach, or satyagraha and nonviolence, is a people-centric approach. It is used to achieve any social and political change, and in fact, it is described as the politics of ordinary people. This form of social struggle has been adopted by mass populations all over the world for their campaign for social justice. Few examples of such non-violent mass protest can be seen in the United States against racism under the banner Black Lives Matter, or the non-violent demonstrations by the people in Hong Kong against the oppressive policies of the Chinese regime. The fact remains that the politics of the ordinary people, in the form of protest, marches, rallies, even hunger strikes, have continued to remain as an effective and potent method of voicing opinion. Number two, Gandhi's experiments in South Africa and India about the independence movement has made him known as the apostle of global peace and human welfare. The very fact that the UN General Assembly wired its resolution ARES 61271 of 15th June 2017 declared that 2nd October, the birth date of Mahatma Gandhi, to be celebrated as the International Day of Nonviolence, is a testimony to his international stature. In the words of the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres,
"In marking the birthday of Mahatma Gandhi, this International Day highlights the remarkable power of nonviolence and peaceful protest. It is also a timely reminder to strive to uphold values that Gandhi lived by, the promotion of dignity, equal protection for all, and communities living together in peace. On this year's observance, we have a special duty: stop the fighting to focus on our common enemy, COVID-19. There is only one winner of conflict during a pandemic, the virus itself. As the pandemic took hold, I called for a global ceasefire. Today, we need a new push by the international community to make this a reality by the end of this year. Ceasefires would ease immense suffering, help to lower the risk of famine, and creates space for negotiations towards peace. Deep mistrust stands in the way. Yet I see reasons for hope. In some places, we see a standstill in the violence. A great many member states, religious leaders, civil society networks, and others back my call. Now is the time to intensify our efforts. Let us be inspired by the spirit of Gandhi and the enduring principles of the UN Charter.
This International Day is an occasion to disseminate the message of nonviolence through education and public awareness. In fact, this resolution is a reflection of the universal respect for Mahatma Gandhi and his enduring relevance of his philosophy. Quoting the late leader's own word, he said, and I quote, "Non-violence is the greatest force at the disposal of mankind. It is mightier than the mightiest weapon of destruction devised by the ingenuity of man." Quotes close. Gandhi believed that 3/4 of the world's miseries and misunderstandings would disappear if we step into the shoes of our adversaries and understand their viewpoint. In fact, this approach is embodied in the UNESCO's motto, which says, and I quote, "Since war began in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed." Quotes close. Third point, Mahatma Gandhi believed that the resolution of conflicts need to be solved by catering to the psychological and ethical approach in his methodology. He believed that though this might be a long-term process, but its efficacy would be long-lasting, since the heart and mind of the conflicting parties are being addressed. In fact, the omnipotent conflict in Jammu and Kashmir can perhaps be resolved keeping this thought process in mind. Number 4. International conflicts can be resolved by seeing international relations on moral grounds. Of course, it's an idealistic school of thought and noble in belief. But is it practical today in the changing geopolitical world order? And especially so in COVID times, where the glaring inequalities are coming to the forefront between the developed and the developing world, where the international organizations like the UN, World Health Organization, which are considered to be leaders in internationalism, have completely, I don't want to use the word failed, but they have completely failed in their response mechanisms, especially in such testing times. Their biases in working machinations are being questioned and mocked by nations all over the world. So where do the ideas of morality stand here? These international organizations themselves have become the mouthpieces of the countries who fund them the most. So where is the morality, I may ask? What I'm saying is, the need certainly is to bring now more than ever the moral values and a little idealism in international relations as well. Otherwise, believing and practicing only strategic interest or tactical considerations in every sphere of activity or engagement, don't you think it is only making nations more and more self-centered, aggressive, assertive, and even violent at times? So with the world moving towards an unending arms race, there is a need to have a strong public opinion to force the respective governments for moving towards disarmament. Though this seems to be a utopian idea, but at least the principles of disarmament should be respected by all. Nations should build themselves on the principles of non-violence for attainment of true peace. Peace in the world does not merely mean cessation of hostilities, but it is freedom from exploitation, freedom from hunger, poverty. Hence, the protracted and structural conflicts need to be addressed, which leads finally to positive peace, growth, and progress in the nation. Point number 5. Gandhi's international order essentially aimed at developing a culture of peace. whereby human beings would be able to curb the aggressiveness and prepare to follow a policy of peaceful coexistence, or at least a policy of non-military competition. He considered war as a creation of minority who would try to impose their will upon the majority. War was unrighteousness because it contradicted the principle of ahimsa and the higher law of dharma. In today's scenario, this thinking is required amongst and between nations even more. Though Gandhi himself believes that to be an internationalist, you need to be a nationalist. But nationalist, not at the cost of waging war on other nations. The seed of war lies in the minds of the people, and peace must be attained by changing their mindset and perceptions. So finally, I just want to say that the need of the hour is to follow Gandhian ideals in creating a climate of amity and harmony in the world, which will further help in preservation of the core values of humanity. This podcast is a tribute to Mahatma Gandhi's views and thoughts on conflict resolution, satyagraha, and it reinforces the belief that even today his legacy lives on and his ideas still inspire movements and spark debates and discussions. One can only agree with Professor Jean Sharp, who believes that today, if nonviolence is understood accurately and applied intelligently, wisely, and courageously, it offers a great hope for a better future for our world. Gandhi's ideology on satyagraha and nonviolence was so widely spread that even great leaders like Martin Luther King accepted and acknowledged. In fact, in one of his interviews, this is what he had to say.
Gandhi, Dr. King, dramatized and defined the technique of nonviolence, and yet he also said that the only alternative to fear is violence, and that if that were the alternative, he would have to choose violence. Do you subscribe to that judgment of Gandhi, or would you disavow violence under any condition?
Well, I think I would have to somewhat interpret Gandhi at this point. I don't think he was setting forth violence as an alternative. I think he was emphasizing, or rather trying to refute an all too prevalent fallacy. And that is that the persons who use the method of nonviolence are actually the weak persons, persons who don't have the weapons of violence, persons who are afraid. I think that is what Gandhi was attempting to refute. Now, in that instance, I would agree with Gandhi that if the only alternative to violence, is violence and vice versa, then I would say fight. But it isn't the only alternative. And that is the one point that Gandhi was trying to bring out.
Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. And see you for the next episode very soon.